Today on KPR Presents, Topeka author Tom Averill and his newest book, Found Documents from the Life of Nell Johnson Dorr.
Saturday, February 16th, 1867, Lawrence, Kansas. Dear brother, I am fine. My search for fossils is not a sign of a grieving, demented mind, as you seem to think. Instead, after the loss of Solomon, my scientific pursuits, I am reading, studying, learning, and discovering all I can about the ancient creatures that inhabited this same place I now walk every day. This is solace. I know that I walk upon layer above layer of life, and that supports me.
That's Tom Averill reading from his latest novel, Found Documents from the Life of Nell Johnson Dorr. Tom, as always, it is great to have you here.
It's great to be with you, Kay.
Before we talk about the title character, Nell Johnson Dorr, tell me first about her husband, Solomon Dorr, and his connection to Kansas.
Well, he's, like her, from Arkansas. And they meet because both of their parents are involved in the Underground Railroad in Arkansas. When I wrote my novel, Road, I was doing research on kind of that Mississippi fault line. Tennessee and Memphis actually was a place where there was a house where people congregated in order to ferry escaped slaves across the Mississippi into Arkansas territory at that time. And so it wasn't a huge route, but it was one of these parts of the Underground Railroad that I had no idea of. And that was a kind of subplot in the novel Road that Robert Johnson, my hero, kind of got involved with a man who was working the Underground Railroad. So I just imagined that in some way they kept doing that. And then when Kansas Territory opened up, that, of course, novel Road was set in 1825, so a good bit before we get to 1854, some 29 years or something. So little Nell, who's a character in Road, grows up in Pine Bluff and meets Solomon through the parents and the Underground Railroad. And so when she marries Solomon, they decide when Lawrence, Kansas, and Kansas Territory open, that they're going to go to Lawrence to join in work with the abolitionists and on the Underground Railroad. So Solomon dedicates himself to that, and he's a real zealous early pioneer of Lawrence, Kansas, and claims a lot of land, fortunately enough land that when he dies in Quantrill's raid, Nell is able to sell some of that property and support herself.
Let's talk about Quantrill's raid, because as you said, Solomon dies in Quantrill's raid, and it's obviously a life-changing event for Nell in a couple ways. Obviously, she loses her husband, she becomes independently wealthy, but also she discovers something in her basement while she's hiding.
That's right. The irony, I think, and this is what got me started in the book, really, is this character, Nell, who's found in the novel Road in a burning cabin. Her mother is dead. Her father's been hung. The cabin's been burned by desperados or whatever. And Nell is just barely alive. So in thinking about this book, I just thought, what if when Nell comes to Kansas, she ends up just like when she was a baby? She's in a foundation of a home. The porch of the home is on fire. And she's lost everybody that's dear to her. She's also already lost a couple of babies to stillbirth herself earlier, and that she alludes to in the book. She's lost everything, and then she sees in the foundation rock fossils, these creatures, and she's sort of thinking Rock of Ages, you know, and singing that hymn to herself, and then in the rock she sees, really, literally, the Rock of Ages. Like, she sees these fossils, and they're both living and dead, like she is. And I think she just has to find out what these creatures are who once inhabited this place. She calls it her salvation in stone because it gives her this purpose and this meaning. If she can just discover what these things are and learn about them and learn what they mean for her, that in some ways she can discover herself and her own meaning. And so it's that pattern that I saw early on with that character that I wanted to follow through. Plus, I'm so very interested in just amateur science and the way Darwin turned the world on its head in 1859, only 5 years after Nell and Solomon come to Kansas Territory.
So she discovers this newfound love of amateur fossil exploration, and it really transforms her life. But obviously, this is a time where women paleontologists were, that was not a thing. Talk to me about how, some of the challenges she faces.
Yes, it was not. She's frowned upon for her interest in science, first of all, especially by the church, which is trying to struggle with this new sense of time, not the creation of 4,000 years ago or 7,000 years ago or the sort of biblical sense of the Earth age, but the scientific sense of the Earth age. So immediately she runs into the conflict with, first of all, with the church, then with other women. You know, what are you doing walking the hills and bluffs, making friends with people like Hugh Cameron, the Kansas hermit, going up to this fledgling university and trying to find mentors who are going to be inevitably male as a now widowed woman. How untoward is that? You're wandering the countryside alone, unaccompanied by a man. You're taking care of all your business affairs by yourself, and doing it in a very independent way. Nell stops going to church for a while because of some of those pressures. And so, yes, she realizes that she looks a little bit fallen. In one letter that she writes to her sister, she says, I see how others see me, and they think of me as fallen. And she said, I have fallen. I've fallen to the earth. I've fallen to rock. I've fallen to this study. She's a person who becomes obsessed, literally, with having to do this. She has to do this. And so she never questions herself and her interest in that, which is something I really admire about her, that she just, it persists in her desire to learn. And the more she learns, the more good thinking she does, and she becomes better at what she's already good at, which is finding fossils, but better at logging them, of thinking about why they're there, and eventually gains the respect of the Natural History Museum in Washington, D.C., and she's sending her fossils to Smith, who's there, and eventually attending some conferences in Emporia, Kansas, of the Kansas Academy of Science, and then later one in Washington, too. So in some ways it's a success story, but it's also a story of hard persistence. And her success is not just in paleontology and invertebrate paleontology and the study of bryozoan fossils, but it's really success in finding her own power and her own making her own world the way she wants it made.
At one point she refers to herself as a dirty Hester Prynne. Yeah. Reference to the Scarlet Letter.
Yeah, and her fossils are her little pearl. Sort of these precious things that no one quite understands how she got to them.
Tom, you're a writer. You're not yourself a paleontologist. Tell me about the research you did in writing found documents.
Well, it was a wonderful journey. I've always had an interest in Kansas and Kansas being part of the Inland Sea, Kansas having so much rich history when it comes to the discovery of fossils. And so I've always enjoyed collecting fossils where I could find them. My father-in-law, Jim Gowdy, was a geologist. He worked for oil companies, but he was always extremely interested in telling us about, you know, this is the Pennsylvanian rock, this is, you know, the different layers. And ironically, he had a cabin in New Mexico where we find some of the same fossils at 8,500 feet in Pennsylvanian rock as you can find in Kansas in Pennsylvanian rock. So it's this really odd sense of space and time that you get with that. And Jim Gowdy had a huge fossil collection. And we have quite a fossil collection and have for years and years. So I knew I wanted to do something with that at some point. The trick is, of course, as you said, doing the research was, first of all, figuring out what kind of fossil Nell might be best at finding. And I wanted to keep her in eastern Kansas. I did go on a little field trip out to the Sternberg Museum and talk to the wonderful paleontologist, Mike Eberhardt, who wrote Oceans of Kansas. And he took us on a back, kind of behind-the-scenes tour of the Sternberg Museum. Wonderful, wonderful stuff. The big fish with the big jaws, the big teeth, and the sharks, and, you know, the whole romance of the ocean of Kansas. And at the end of our time, I said, well, you know, I think I maybe am going to have Nell study bryozoan fossils. What do you think of that? And he said, I think you'll have a boring book. Because it is true that moss bryozoans, you know, first of all, they're bryozoans are not extinct. They still exist in warm climates. They're kind of like coral. So there are species of them that are extinct. And they're, of course, extinct in Kansas because the environment no longer supports them. But I was studying something that I didn't know much about and had to learn a lot about. And then the trick was not just learning a lot about bryozoan fossils, but learning what people knew about bryozoan fossils at each step from 1863, when Nell gets interested in them, until 1890. And the kind of history of science then became really interesting as well. So you find an early 1850s book called The Rocks of Kansas, in which people are still arguing whether there are layers of Pennsylvanian rock in the state, and what kinds of, so very early on, just trying to map out. In a way, I felt sort of like Nell herself. Is like I was discovering, just as she was discovering, reading the material that she might have read, rereading Darwin. And Darwin made this call in his Origin of Species. He said, the record is not complete. You know, we need more evidence. And amateur scientists began to collect like the early transactions of the Kansas Academy of Science. And by the way, the Kansas Academy of Science is the oldest academy west of the Mississippi in Kansas. And they're having their annual conference this April at Washburn. And some of the Washburn scientists were the very first people involved in the Kansas Academy of Science. So it's nice that it's returning to Washburn for this conference this year. So I looked through a lot of the transactions. They're called transactions. It's basically just the publication. So many of them are just lists of birds that were sighted, that were seen for the first time. It's like rounding out, just collecting what's here in the state. Lizards, moths, butterflies. And, of course, I have another character from Missouri in the book, who Sally Miller, who is an amateur lepidopterist, you know, collecting butterfly specimens. And I'm fascinated by sort of the early science and Kansas's role in geology with Benjamin Mudge, who's in the book.
And he's a real person.
And he is a real person. He is a man who actually, very serendipitously, I found this out. I knew about him, but he had come to Kansas to settle in Quindaro, which is right on the Missouri River, to work on the Underground Railroad as an abolitionist, just like Nell. He was a lawyer, And then he got interested in nature and in fossils and in rocks. And so he started collecting himself, and he was fairly much self-taught. He was our first state geologist who took his cabinet of curiosities, which so many 19th century scientists had, to Kansas State Agricultural College. And he and Francis Snow of KU, who was much more interested in birds and living things, Snow is famously said to him, I'll study the living, you study the dead. And so Mudge became the fossil guy. And of course, Mudge and Samuel Williston, who was at Kansas State Agricultural College and at KU, they both took expeditions out to western Kansas and found the shark's teeth and the big monsters as well. And Nell just sticks with her bryozoans. So I spent hours at the Invertebrate Paleontology Lab here on the KU campus, in the archives at Spencer here, in the archives at K-State, studying the Mudge and Williston and people that they have papers from. A lot of time at Watkins Museum. Just a lot of research involved with it. But it was kind of the same kind of research my character would have been doing. And so it just fed the book in that way.
So she's learning about fossils and herself. You're learning about fossils. And you're also learning about scientific inquiry at that time.
Yes. And kind of the scientific mind and how it works. And I've always loved science, and I especially admired people like Oliver Sacks, for example. He's a real influence on this book, because I started reading his autobiography, his memoir called On the Move, I think it was called, and the way he thought about science. He was a real admirer of 19th century scientists, and particularly medical doctors, because he was a person who didn't trust instant diagnoses. So that people who just saw someone and labeled them as certain, you know, Sacks spent his whole life in narrative, telling stories about people with certain brain impairments and so on, in awakenings, and The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, and books like that. And he himself read a lot of 19th century medical accounts, because that's where he could find out what really was going on with people. They didn't have the names for it. They were just describing a series of symptoms, but they did it in a narrative style. And that's what I love so much about Oliver Sacks and 19th century science.
It's interesting that at that time, the body of knowledge really relied on amateurs, people that didn't have any scientific training. You know, you think in this day and age, as an amateur fossil collector, that it seems almost pretentious to think that you might have something, you know, of real value to add to the body of knowledge. But at that time, that was really, that's who was on the ground doing the work.
That's right. And some major collections. And even here in Lawrence, there's a character in the book who's actually a real character, Joseph Savage, who's mentioned a few times in the book. He was another amateur fossil hunter who sent his work to Washington, D.C. And he lived in Lawrence, Kansas, and studied what he could, but he was not a scientist. So, yeah, science really relied on that. Now, not so much. There are a few projects where people are asked to observe things in their immediate environment and send data to these huge databases on computers. That's sort of the contemporary equivalent of that. But back then, you could get a paper in the Transactions of the Kansas Academy just by being an observant human being. Lewis Lindsay Dyke himself was a boy who just loved to rove around, and he discovered specimens and he brought them to the university, and people realized he had a scientific bent, and then he started studying that, and then look what he created, the diorama, and traveled all over the world. So, yeah, just a Kansas boy out collecting lizards and turtles and things like that.
I'm visiting with Tom Averill. His latest book is Found Documents from the Life of Nell Johnson Dorr. Tom, I have to admit, I read the first 15 pages of this book and thought, is this fiction or nonfiction? I went back to the beginning, reread the first 15 pages, and thought, okay, I'm pretty sure this is fiction. Tell me about this genre of archival fiction.
Well, I've always enjoyed including documents in my work, whether it's poems, songs, recipes, critiques, you know, those kinds of fake documents. And I was attracted to the notion of writing a book that would had the scope that this one has from 1854, just the timeline, 1854 to 1890. How do I tell Nell's story? What narrative technique do I use? How to do that? Do I want to write about her, or do I want to write as her? And I just thought, you know, if I can do it all, and I've spent hours myself in various archives doing research, and I just thought, why don't I just create an archive that I can pretend I'm researching it, and so that way I don't have to do a lot of chronological transitions. I don't have to say she walked across the room. You know, I mean, Nell is a diarist, and she's a letter writer. And so she's doing what all diarists and letter writers do, which is to kind of self-consciously chronicle your life for yourself and then for others around you. And I thought that would be a good strategy. I can have her deciding what's important on any given day. And my fake editor says, well, there's a lot of entries you wouldn't want to read. Hot today, you know, won't be out, or, you know, ripped my dress. It's like, I don't want those kinds of things. And I can pretend to pick out those moments that are really important, where she's challenging others, she's challenging herself, she's making decisions, she's making notes about a speech she wants to give to the church ladies now that she's kind of back into the fold. And I don't have to have but one or two each year, even if I don't want to. I can tell a story by letting her tell her story. And there were times when I really did feel like I was in an archive. One of my young writer friends, Ben Lerner, whose parents, Steve and Harriet, live in Lawrence, once wrote that writing is nothing but really close reading. And I think about that as a writer, that sometimes you write one word and the next word sort of appears, almost like you're reading it as well as writing it. And I wrote a lot of this book longhand on purpose, because I wanted that pace that Nell would have in writing the diary and the letters. And so sometimes I really felt like I was not writing, but I was transcribing what was there. It just sort of came to me. And of course, I did research, reading diaries and letters from that time period. And it's a time period that I've always been interested in, as someone who taught Kansas literature, and I've read so much of 19th century Kansas writing. So it just struck me as a good strategy for telling this particular story.
I'm wondering if there's a parallel here in something that Nell wrote to her friend Lydia. She says, there are words first, then sentences, then paragraphs, then grand ideas. Is that how you write, or do you start with the grand idea of...
Oh, I don't think I have any grand ideas. Yeah, I think word by word. You know, the famous Anne Lamott, bird by bird, and I think of it as word by word and being carried along. I mean, I think you make a very good point, though, because even when you're working in a real archive, you have all this material, and yet you have to come up with what it means. What is it really saying about a given life at a particular time? And what does it say that now speaks to our lives at this time? And so those things gradually tease themselves together. For me, one of the things that brought this all together was that Nell, as a baby, is rescued. She's found. She's discovered. And then as an adult, she becomes a rescuer with her work on the Underground Railroad, and a finder and a discoverer. And in so doing, she finds herself and her own talent, uses her own talent and her own mental ability to become a person not of any significant historical note, but a person who contributed to the world in a very positive way, all through this compulsion to find and discover and to know, which I think is, you know, something I really admire in the people around me, and something that I could see Nell doing and insisting upon. And she's good at telling the truth, and she's good at knowing how she appears to others. And she's modest, but at the same time, she has respect for herself, which you can have at the same time, I think. Great self-respect, but also modesty. And she doesn't want to be bound by convention. And that's not hard for her, because she's so interested in other things besides how she looks or how she dresses or whether she's with a man or not, or has children or not. You know, she accepts her life too. And in some ways she identifies with her fossils. She's just a creature who's on this world for a given amount of time and is living the best she can.
I'm visiting with Topeka author Tom Averill. His latest book is Found Documents from the Life of Nell Johnson Dorr. I'm Kay McIntyre. You're listening to KPR Presents on Kansas Public Radio.
Support for KPR comes from Theater Lawrence presenting Ring of Fire. From the songbook of Johnny Cash comes this unique musical with more than 24 classic hits, playing weekends March 2nd through March 11th. Tickets at theaterlawrence.com.
As you said, this is a work of fiction, and yet there are real people scattered in and out of it. I'm curious about the Kansas Hermit. Was that a real person?
Yes, Hugh Cameron was a famous Lawrence person. He came here fairly early on, and he was a general, and after the war, some say that he had a love affair that went bad and sort of became a hermit. He lived. Do you know where the KPL plant is? On the bluffs of the river, just north and west of Lawrence. Mm-hmm. That was Cameron's Bluff, it was called. And he lived sort of a wild life out there by himself. He later moved into town, and there's a little plaque dedicated to him in the Pinckney neighborhood that you can still go and visit today. And he lived in a treehouse. So he was a very eccentric guy.
You mean actually he lived in a tree?
Yes. And my brother, Rick Averill, has done some Hugh Cameron sketches before, early on, to entertain people and especially kids. And my friend Steve Lerner was doing a lot of research on Hugh Cameron because he was so interested in him. Cameron was a famous walker. He hated public transportation, the railroad and so on, and he was purported to have walked to each presidential inauguration from Lawrence to Washington, D.C., where he had once lived. I do have Nell accompanying him on one of those journeys. She doesn't get far with him, but that's where she meets Sally Miller in Missouri, and that's a serendipitous thing for her. Cameron later was actually tasked himself to take a letter of apology from the state of Kansas to Edmund Ross, who was in New Mexico as a territorial governor. Ross had been a Kansas senator who voted he got excoriated for saving the Johnson presidency after Abraham. You know, Johnson was impeached by the Senate, and Ross refused to vote against Johnson, and so Johnson remained president. And Kansans didn't like that. They thought that Johnson was being soft on, you know, Reconstruction and that kind of stuff. And then later on, of course, Ross's vote is now seen to be a heroic gesture, and Kennedy wrote about it in Profiles in Courage there. But Hugh Cameron was just a really interesting figure. And so I felt like I had to include him. And I had a very serendipitous thing happen, because I have Nell meeting him, because she would be very interested in Cameron's Bluff, because a bluff is a great place to find fossils. So she's meandering toward that part of the river along where the bluffs are above the river, and she kind of trespasses on his territory, and he lets her know that
he's a hermit.
He doesn't appreciate that. And she also discovers some letters which were from this former romantic interest. Of course, I'm making all of this up, combining historical reality with fiction and historical fiction. But one afternoon, when I'd spent about 3 hours photographing invertebrate bryozoan fossils at the Invertebrate Paleontology Lab here at KU, I ran across in a box a little specimen. They're all in little boxes, and they all say where they were found and by who and when. And one of the fossils, bryozoan fossils, was identified as being from Cameron's Bluff. So I thought,
bingo.
One of those moments where you think, I must be doing something right. You know, maybe this could have happened.
The gods were smiling on you there.
Yes, they were. And I was tired that day after photographing for 3 hours. And right at the end, it's like, boom, there's Cameron's Bluff right there.
This book does include a lot of images of fossil life, but in keeping with the time period, they wouldn't have been photographed as you had done. The sketches in the book, are they your own?
Yes, they are. I thought if I was going to have a fake archive, I wanted sort of material evidence of it. So I had some help at the end from an artist friend of mine, Clint Ricketts, who is a Lawrence artist and teaches some at Washburn and some at Johnson County Community College. But the diary entries where you see Nell's handwriting and her drawings, I did all of those myself in early drafts. And
I thought I recognized that handwriting.
Yeah. I modeled it after my grandmother's handwriting. She didn't have the sort of cute cursive that a lot of people had at that time. She was a scratcher. And she was born in 1890, which is when this book ends. So in some ways, she was kind of my connection to Nell and her generation, that sense of time anyway, thinking through time. So I did want to include some fake nail drawings and other things, and she gets to be a better artist as she's drawing fossils as the book goes on, as you might expect. And I think she actually becomes a more disclosing diarist and letter writer too as the book progresses, because she's getting so good at it from a lifetime of writing.
In reading found documents from the life of Nell Johnson Dorr, I came across a sentence that certainly could have rung true for Nell, but kind of also rang true here in 2018. She's talking about her logging of fossils and some of the challenges that she's facing. And then she writes, "Nevertheless, I persist."
I don't remember writing that, but I'm glad I did. Because it must be before I ran across that. I mean, it must be before I ran across it.
Really?
You know, in
popular culture.
Yeah, in popular culture. So, I mean, I'm not aware. Of course, we're all sponges, and I'm always happy when something comes to me. But yeah,
Tom, I assume that you planted that in there as sort of a nod to the persistence of the female spirit through the ages.
Well, I I am quite aware of certain parallels, I think, in this book and contemporary issues. I mean, we still have a great tension between scientific thinking and spiritual thinking and religious thinking and the denial of scientific fact, which is so prevalent right now. The problems we've had in Kansas with the teaching of evolution, for example, Nell would be turning over in her grave. Haven't we fought that battle before and come to some at least acceptable standoff? No, that persists. And then, you know, the way we think of women, the persistent and constant misogyny that's expressed over and over again. For example, when Nell does get a paper accepted for a conference in Washington, a man has to read it because a woman has never delivered a paper then. And you could say, oh, well, that's so quaint. It happened to Mary Anning, too, in the book Remarkable Creatures. Mary Anning was finding fossils in England, south coast of England, in the early 1800s. And she found creatures that no one could account for. And she was even accused of, like, cobbling bones together to create something sort of mythical. And then they realized, no, this is something. And so someone was going to present on her findings. She went to England, to London, to a meeting. She was not allowed to sit in the room. She had to sit on a stairway where no one could see her, even though this is all based on her work in finding fossils. So you see that, and then you think, well, this is a thing of the past, but it's not. It's still the misogyny there that is still prevalent. And so it's a book for our times, too. Same kinds of issues issues of race, too.
Talk to me about how you explore issues of race in the found documents from the life of Nell Johnson Dorr.
Well, it becomes something that Nell is not as obsessed by post-Civil War, of course, post-Quantrill's Raid and post the death of her husband, but she grew up in a family that cared about the rights of everybody, and a very democratic family with a small d democratic, and a family that was dedicated to helping to end slavery. And so she's surrounded by all these Massachusetts people. She goes to the first Thanksgiving that was held in Lawrence, Kansas. Thank you to Katie Armitage for that, finding that article and publicizing it for me. And all of these people are concerned with kind of justice and the abolition of slavery, and Kansas coming in as a free state. And even when I do have a little celebration of the 25th anniversary of the founding of Lawrence. And that's based on historical fact, and the kinds of people that came to Lawrence at that time are still interested in all of these causes. And Nell at one point in the book says, you know, am I just cursed to live in interesting times, or do people make their times interested by being engaged in what's really important in any time? And I think she trades some of those social justice and racial justice issues for women's rights, and supports Sally Miller when Sally Miller becomes more of a suffragist and working for women's suffrage, and even comes to Kansas to do that. And more interested in educating people about science and time and what this says about our world. But, you know, each thing that comes along, she's passionate and engaged about it.
You know, I remember reading that about interesting times and thinking, I don't know what time period you would refer to as being not interesting. They're all interesting times.
Mm-hmm. You could pick any of them. I think, though, there are certain moments in those interesting times. For example, in the in the 1968, 69, a lot was coming to a head, you know, and I think that's true of our time right now. A lot of things are coming together to make things pretty chaotic.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
People are afraid of what's going to happen, and but I think the 19th century has always been interesting to me because of all of these causes that came out of that.
And as someone who's interested in Kansas history, I can imagine it's a really fun time. It's a fun setting to put characters in.
Oh yeah, it very much so, because you go from Free State Kansas and the territorial bleeding Kansas into the Civil War, and Kansas's role in that. Kansans, you know, we lost more people to the Civil War and wounded per capita than any other state. So then we're settled by Union Army veterans, you know, and there's a real zeal for women's rights. The Kansas Constitution in 1861, as written, was more liberal than the Massachusetts Constitution. And that's true of a lot of Western states that kind of got infected by those reforms. And then Prohibition, which comes along as a progressive movement to try to sober up America. And that's an important part, women's suffrage issues. So all of these things, Kansas is really at the forefront of all of these changes, and then to discover that we're also at the forefront of certain scientific discoveries about what fossils lie hidden in the West. It's an exciting time. Hmm.
Your title character's name is Nell Johnson Dorr. How did you pick that name for her?
Well, it's interesting. Of course, Nell, she was named Nell by Robert and Joe Johnson, who didn't know her name
from your previous book,
Road. She was
baby.
Yeah, so she's Nell Johnson. And then I had her marrying a man named Gates. I like that idea that she's a person who opens gates, you know, all of her life. And then when I was doing the research, I discovered that there was a family named Gates who actually settled in Lawrence and were part of those founding citizens. So I thought, well, I can't confuse fiction and history that much, so I'll have her opening doors instead of gates. So I thought of the name Dorr, and it's funny what you know and don't know. But it's not really an important metaphor, but it sort of speaks to that notion of being open, as Nell is. I ran across so many interesting names and people in early Lawrence history. And I have to thank a lot of people like Katie Armitage and Virgil Dean and people who are so knowledgeable about Lawrence for helping me out and talking to me about the book. It was a real collaborative effort. I would look at some of those early businesses in Lawrence, like what drugstore is Nell going to go to buy something, and it mentions Woodward. B.J. Woodward had a drugstore. He was the first pharmacist in Lawrence. And ironically, in my home, from when I owned some property in East Lawrence and was gardening, I dug up a little vial, a glass vial that said B.W. Woodward Round Corner Drug on it. And then while I was writing this book, I met Woodward's great-great-great-grandson, Pete Woodward, who gave me some early Kansas books that had to do with pharmacy. So all these serendipitous things happened to me. And, you know, I think when you live in a place and you know a place, and then you really start digging in and researching a place, you realize how many connections are there. And that's one of the fun things about laying fiction onto historical fact.
So Found Documents from the Life of Nell Johnson Dorr came out this month. You're making a number of appearances, readings in connection with the release of this book, including one coming up here in Lawrence.
That's right. I'm really excited to be invited to the Watkins Community Museum, where I did some of the research and got some help from them, on March 2nd, a Friday at 6 o'clock. It's co-sponsored by the Lawrence Public Library and Raven Bookstore. So we're hoping to have a nice group of people come and talk about the book in terms of its Lawrence history, but also just in terms of the characters and Nell herself. March 14th, I'll be reading it at Mabee Library at Washburn University. That's another close by event. March 1st, I'll be in Watermark Books in Wichita. And so I'm kind of hitting all those great bookstores that I love and the places that help me research and write the book.
One of the things that I discovered reading the found documents from the life of Nell Johnson Dorr was that when you're looking for fossils, that weather makes a difference.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I learned that idea from some friends of mine, Myrna and Elmer Schlegel, who live in western Kansas. And their daughter, when she was young, used to love to find fossils on their place. They live out by Ogallala and the chalk bluffs out there. And their daughter once found a mosasaur. And Mike Everhart from...
A mosasaur, you mean one of the big sea
lizards?
Yeah,
one of the big fish. They dug it out, and it was a complete skeleton except for the head, but it was a really nice one. And Myrna and Elmer told me that their daughter loved thunderstorms, and because whenever you got a good freeze or a good thunderstorm or some cataclysmic weather, things erode, things become exposed. The whole world changes. So you might go out one day, not find anything. After a thunderstorm, you go out, there's the fossil in the bluff that you hadn't seen before. And I have Nell write a couple times just in praise of weather and cold and extreme heat. She loves all of these things because they actually affect the earth a lot more than a pleasant day.
And what a great metaphor for discovering things maybe about yourself.
Yes.
After you've been through a storm.
Exactly. And that seems to be one of Nell's metaphors, is that tragedy is followed by discovery, self-discovery and discovery of other things.
I had not known that. I guess I've always just assumed that if a fossil is in the ground, it's there. It's either going to be discovered because it's on the surface or it's not.
Yeah, or the ground changes. The Lawrence poet Denise Lowe has done a lot of finding of bones and fossils among the sandbars of the Kansas River. And she writes about that too, that when you get these big, you know, floods coming through, it churns everything up. And then you want to go right out there as soon as the water goes down, and you might see an exposed bone that she's found ancient bones in the Kansas River. And so I also kind of learned that from Denise as well. It's funny how, you know, things come to you when you're writing that you wouldn't necessarily share them with friends and family as some kind of insight, but when you're living with a character who really spends all of her time studying the earth and the ground, she's very aware of all those little things that change with the seasons and with the weather.
As I mentioned elsewhere, found documents of Nell Johnson Dorr weaves real life characters in with the fictitious characters of her story. Somebody that makes an interesting cameo appearance is L. Frank Baum, author of Wizard of Oz.
That's right. I had run across, when I did research on L. Frank Baum, I had read over and over again that he'd never been in Kansas, but he'd chosen Kansas as the setting for The Wizard of Oz. And then as I was doing research once for an article I was doing on Baum and why he chose Kansas, I did discover that he had played at the Bowersock Opera House in the 1880s, it was, early 1880s perhaps. And he had played in December, and it was a very dismal gray day, which is how he describes Kansas. And he he was doing one of his plays. It was a four-person play called The Maid of Iran. And so I thought, wouldn't it be just sort of insider joke
wink, wink.
to have Nell attend that performance on that awful Sunday and be a little critical of it too, because not a lot of people even realize that Baum spent some time right here in Lawrence. So it was a fun little cameo thing to put in there.
Knowing of your interest in The Wizard of Oz and L. Frank Baum, I thought it was a nice little wink wink moment.
Yeah. Yeah. It's on Wednesday, December 6, 1882. And she says, "I braved terrible cold to see a theatrical piece showing at the Bowersock Opera House." And she's a little bit critical of it. And but then she realizes, she says, "All amusement was frozen by the temperature, I suppose." Because Bowersock was not heated at that time. So, and then she admits that this young man, "I braved the cold but remained chilled, and so I write perhaps unfairly about this troupe who certainly have ambitions beyond the small towns of Kansas." And so she's writing about L. Frank Baum, but she doesn't know what he's going to do in 1900. Yeah, there are fun little wink moments like that.
I'm visiting with Topeka author Tom Averill about his latest novel, Found Documents of Nell Johnson Dorr. It's the fictitious story of a woman's search for fossils and herself in Lawrence in the mid to late 1800s. I'm Kay McIntyre. You're listening to KPR Presents on Kansas Public Radio. Tom, we open the hour with an excerpt from Found Documents. Can I get you to read another excerpt?
Sure. The very last entry doesn't really give anything away. It just sort of talks about Nell's attitude about her life. It might be a good one. It's a diary entry from July 22nd, 1890. And it's after the death of her mother, her, you know, adopted mother. She calls her Mother Jo. And Father Robert has already died. Her sister sends her all the letters and also sends her a geode, a rock that was found near where she was born. And it is sat on the mantelpiece and no one ever broke it open. So she gets it, and I'll just read this very last diary entry. "The stone is a geode, and it rested on the mantel so long we did not even notice it. That it was gathered from the place of my birth and near death is a shock to me. How much else was kept from me of my circumstances before Robert and Joe Johnson rescued me from a smoldering cabin and claimed me as their own? Who were my parents? Shall I always be doomed to live many lives, to be many persons? Baby Onan became Nell Johnson. Nell Johnson became Mrs. Solomon Dorr. Mrs. Solomon Dorr became Widow Dorr. Widow Dorr became the shunned fossil hunter and scandal. The shunned fossil hunter and scandal became the respected supplier of the National Museum. The respected supplier became a writer whose words were presented to the National Academy. And now she becomes a motherless child, sent a rock for her heritage. I broke the rock, one clean bit of hammer on chisel. Each half was a cave full of purple crystals, amethyst, like sharp teeth, jagged, mirroring light, color softening at the points, a beauty hidden all these years. My father knew what was inside. He wanted to break the rock, but he did not. As I have learned from my own studies, much of what we know is on the surface only. Many think we are not meant to delve deeply. We are afraid to break the rock. Who knows what we might find inside? I have broken the rock and found beauty. Over and over, I have broken the rock."
That's Tom Averill reading from Found Documents from the Life of Nell Johnson Dorr. Tom, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you so much for having me. What a lovely conversation. Really appreciate it.